The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in again for Mr. Stephen Flurry. He is literally travelling over to the Netherlands right now, as our introducer says every week. I thought I'd begin by giving a general overview of some of the big news today, and then we'll go in more detail on one particular story from this week. Now, a lot of the news that's emerged from today and from yesterday can be summed up in one word: negotiations. Just about everything we'll talk about in this first segment revolves around some important negotiations going on in Europe and the Middle East right now. As you heard in the news at the top of the hour, there's lots of negotiations going on in the Middle East and attempts at peace deals. And as you heard, the UN has brokered a peace deal in Libya. So there are two separate parliaments there, and both sides have now signed up, or at least some people from both sides have signed up to a UN unity plan. And at the same time, today, some key people are meeting at the UN to hammer out some kind of peace deal for Syria. And rather than really being about peace, it's trying to kind of forge some kind of accommodation between the pro-Assad Bashar al-Assad and the anti-Bashar al-Assad forces, so they can both fight against the Islamic State. And as you heard earlier this week on this program, the US made this possible by essentially capitulating to Syria over Russia and dropping their commitment that America's leaders have repeated again and again and again, that Bashar al-Assad must go. They've now decided that they don't really mind too much. And so that's paved the way for these negotiations and for this possibly more unified front against the Islamic State. Now, I think it's very clear that none of these peace deals are going to last. In Libya, some important people on both sides have already condemned it. Syria is a big mess, and the UN has a horrible track record at solving even small messes, so it's not going to fix anything there. But these peace negotiations could still be significant, because they could both pave the way, possibly, for some kind of European military mission, or at least UN peacekeeping forces. A lot of sides, especially the European Union and people in the UN, have talked about this kind of peace deal that we've seen come about in Libya as being a necessary step on the way to a UN military mission. And so now that they've got this agreement in place, even though there's still a lot of tension about it, it could pave the way for European nations to get military involved in Libya. And it's the same with Syria. Again, this kind of negotiation could lead to a UN military mission. And Spiegel had an article last week that we talked about on our Trumpet Hour program, where if there was some kind of UN military mission, then Germany would probably get involved with that. They've talked so much about doing more in the world and especially taking more responsibility for the Middle East that they would really feel obliged to back up those words with action and would come out looking pretty weak if they don't. At the same time, senior German military officials have talked about the importance of a military mission in Libya. I think Germany itself is much more reluctant to get involved there, especially after the mess that NATO's military mission made. But they would like to see maybe a NATO send troops, or France and Italy and Britain to send soldiers in. Again, there's still the potential, I think, for Germany. So even though these peace deals won't solve anything, they could be significant in getting Europe much more involved within the region. Now, we've also talked about a fair bit at the Trumpet that Libya is going to end up in the Iranian allied camp. It's not going to end up under Europe's influence. So if there is some kind of European military mission, it obviously is not going to be successful there. But nonetheless, these negotiations could end up now drawing Europe into the Middle East, and that could be very significant. Now, there have also been big negotiations going on at the European Union, starting yesterday, going on into today. As part of that, again, as we heard of the news at the top of the hour, Britain has kind of launched its negotiations about its place in Europe. And the road ahead for Britain and its relationship with the European Union is that they're going to try and renegotiate the terms of their membership in the European Union. And then they'll turn around to the British people and have a referendum as to whether to stay in the European Union with these new terms of membership or to quit and to go it alone. And there's already a clear consensus in Britain that the nation does not want to be so closely involved in Europe. But there's a split as to what to do about it. There's on the one hand, people who want to be part of the European Union. They may not like everything about it, but they think on balance, Britain is better off in. And then there are those that would like Britain to quit. And the polls indicate, at least, that these negotiations that Britain launched yesterday could be very important in terms of Britain's place within the European Union. They show that if Britain doesn't get many concessions from the European Union, and the terms of its membership basically remain as is, then a majority want Britain to leave. However, if Britain gets substantial concessions from the European Union, then the polls indicate that a majority want Britain to stay. So this could have an important bearing on Britain's place in the EU. Now, the big thing that these negotiations revolve around, or the biggest part of them, is access to in-work benefits. So at the moment, somebody, just to kind of give some background behind this, someone can move to the UK from Poland. They could work a minimum wage job, and then they could get money, extra money from the government, from the British government, to supplement that income. Because there are a few different benefits available to people on low wages in the UK, like housing benefit, that allows people to claim money from the government even if they're in work. But the concern is that for somebody living in Eastern Europe, even a minimum wage job in the UK is much better pay than they're going to get at home. And then when you add getting money from the government on top of that it will pull more people in, you'll have more people immigrating to the UK. And Britain is already not, a lot of people in Britain are very unhappy with the level of immigration from the European Union. This is probably the biggest thing that upsets the most people about the EU. Now, this isn't really a problem for other European countries because they have what's called a contributory benefit system. And the way that works is you can only get money out of the benefit system back from the government if you've paid money into it. So in a country with a contributory benefit system, someone could move there from Poland. When they first arrive, they can't claim anything from the government. They can't get any in-work benefits. They can't get any benefits at all because they've not paid any money into the nation's benefit system. But in the UK, that doesn't apply. People can arrive and get benefits on day one. And that, as I said, is an exception. That's different to most of the rest of Europe. And so to address this, Mr. Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, he wants to make immigrants wait 4 or 5 years before they can get access to in-work benefits. Now, this is the most contentious part of the European Union. Most of the rest of Europe are saying no. So this is a very interesting fight, or diplomatic fight, I guess, it's a bit of an oxymoron, but we'll put it that way, because it could determine whether Britain quits the EU or whether it stays. Now, at the trumpet, we've been saying for years that Britain will not be part of the superstate that we can see Europe developing into. And Mr. Armstrong wrote that pretty much as soon as the UK joined. And really, he's already been proved right on this. Britain is not part of the euro. Another major condition that Britain wants from this negotiation about its place in Europe is an opt-out of ever closer union. So EU treaties commit all the European nations, all members of the European Union, to seek ever closer union, to keep drawing closer together. And Britain has never really liked this. And so now they're looking for a formal opt-out. And it looks like that's not so much of a contentious demand. So really, we can already see Mr. Armstrong is right. Britain does not want to be part of a European superstate. It's now just deciding on exactly what this peripheral relationship with this state is going to look like, whether they're going to be part of some kind of outside group of nations or whether they're just going to quit the EU entirely, which is probably the much more likely course. But it's interesting to watch and to see how Britain's relationship changes as Europe builds to building the superstate. Now, at the same time, at the same summit, there was something even more important going on, and that is Europe, they were and they will be talking about how to secure their borders. And this could be a really big deal. I have an article up that went up today on our website called Paris Attacks Reveal the Outlines of a New Europe. And one of the biggest things that's under discussion to try and address the migrant crisis and to solve this problem of many refugees and migrants coming across Europe's border is to create something called a European Border and Coast Guard Force. And basically what this is a mini European army. The creation of this, if it goes ahead, will be big news. And yesterday, the EU, they said that they're going to try and get this force up and running by the end of June. Now, this force was so revolutionary that when they started discussing it and when plans came out towards the end of last week and then were unveiled in more detail at the beginning of this week, I wouldn't have been at all surprised had they been shot down. Because this represents a huge power grab by the EU. This force would be able to deploy to an EU nation even without that nation's permission. So the EU could decide that Greece wasn't taking care of its borders properly, which is something they have condemned Greece for just earlier this month. And if they decided that, then they could send in this border force, which is armed men, boats, helicopters, drones, send them into Greece to fix it. And they could do that even if Greece said, no, we do not want you there. We do not want this armed force there. And that's a huge power grab. I mean, one of the most essential things that makes a nation state, a sovereign state, is a monopoly of force within its borders. You can go back all the way back to kind of key thinkers in terms of the idea of a nation state, like men like Thomas Hobbes. And this was one of the core points of what makes a nation a state. They have a monopoly of force within their borders. Nobody else has the right to send an army in there. And Max Weber, who was the foundation of a lot of this thinking as well in the 20th century, he basically used this to define what is a state. A state is a country that has a monopoly of force within its borders. And that is what these EU nations are giving up. They're talking about now allowing a central European power to deploy forces within their territory. And if this goes ahead, this will be one of the biggest surrenders of sovereignty in the history of the EU. Now, there's still 6 months of negotiations to go on this, so we don't know exactly how it will end up. And there will be some resistance to this idea because it is such a big power grab. I mean, if you just look at the geography of Europe, Germany and France, they're never going to have this border force deployed against their will in their countries because they don't really have any borders with nations outside of the European Union. So they quite like this idea, but nations like Greece, nations like Italy that are on the Mediterranean, they may put up a fight against this. So it will be interesting to see how it develops. The force that they're talking about at the moment is only about 2,000 or 2,500 strong. So it is a very small force, but I think any bigger and there's no way it would go through. I think they have to start it because this is such a big, the principle here is such a large transfer of sovereignty. They have to start on a small scale to have any chance of getting it accepted. Once that is accepted, it would be much easier then to ramp this up from about 2,500 to start including more nations in there. But just in conceding this step in principle, they'd be taking a huge step towards a super state. Well, that's it for the overview. We'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll look at one major story from Europe this week in a bit more detail.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week, condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com, sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. This is KPCG FM. You can listen online at kpcg.fm or in the Edmond, Oklahoma region on 101.3 on the FM dial. Now we're going to look more in detail at one big story from Europe this week, and this is German Chancellor Angela Merkel had a very important speech that she gave on Monday. It's been called the speech of her career. Chancellor Merkel is not really known for being a great public speaker. However, this speech went down really well. She's under a lot of pressure. A lot of people disagree with her policy on immigration. And so this was her speech to the party conference. And as I said, there's been a lot of rumors of dissatisfaction within her party. So she was on a lot of pressure, and she really, like I said, delivered what a lot of people have called the speech of her career. At the end, there was an applause that lasted nearly 10 minutes, and it only ended when Merkel herself said, "Thanks, but we have work to do," and brought that to an end. Now, there's one particular thing that she said in this speech that I really want to talk about, but before we get into that, I'll just give a general overview of what she said. And essentially she moved, it was about immigration, and essentially, or at least the really important part of it was about immigration, and essentially she moved to the right on immigration somewhat without compromising kind of her core principles and beliefs on immigration in Europe. She built on this kind of we can do this theme that she's had all throughout the immigration crisis, and she did this in a very interesting way by basically appealing to Germany's national pride. And she basically built this case saying, you know, yes, there are a lot of problems associated with helping these migrants. Yes, it's going to be hard. But look at what we've done. We've built a peaceful post-war German state. People said that was impossible. We've successfully unified Germany and brought in East Germany and integrated the two halves of Germany together. And people said that was impossible. Here's a quote. She said, "It's in our country's identity to achieve bigger things." So there was this kind of just this emotional appeal. Again, just more detail on this. We can do this attitude that she's had towards immigration all along. But then she also did move with popular opinion somewhat far, far from all the way. She spoke more about limiting immigrants than she has before. She made it clear that Germany will be deporting more migrants that they believe don't need Germany's help, and talked about working with Turkey and other nations and putting in more structures in place to prevent immigrants coming into the European Union. Previously, she said that there can be no limit to the number of refugees Germany can accept. And this time she talked about how Germany may be reaching the limit of the number of refugees it can take. And she said, we want to and we will reduce the number of refugees noticeably. So there was still kind of the sticking to her core message on the one hand while moving with the people a bit to the other. But what was most interesting about this speech is some comments that she made about multiculturalism. And we have a recording lined up from this speech just so you can kind of get a sense of the atmosphere. It is in German, so I'll read the translation while we play that recording. "Those fleeing from persecution will find protection with us. Those who found refuge and protection with us must obey our laws, values, and traditions. And in order to understand us, they must learn the German language." All this, dear friends, is integration. All this is the exact opposite of multiculturalism. It remains true that multiculturalism leads to parallel societies, and multiculturalism therefore remains a lie. So just in case you couldn't hear that too well, multiculturalism leads to parallel societies, and multiculturalism therefore remains a lie. Now, multiculturalism, this is the way Germany and all of Europe has dealt with immigration for decades. And Ms. Merkel here is saying that it is a lie. Now, this isn't the first time that Angela Merkel has made these kind of comments. Actually, all the way back in December 2004, she called multiculturalism a failure. In 2010, she said something similar. She said that it had failed, utterly failed. But typically and historically, these aren't the kind of statements that you get from mainstream political leaders. And until Ms. Merkel started saying those kind of things, it was only leaders on the fringe that talked about the failures of multiculturalism. And even though she has talked about this before, the mention of this in this speech, I still think, is very significant. Because talking about the failings of multiculturalism, when you're in the middle of an immigration crisis, that's much more significant than just kind of talking about the failures of multiculturalism on a general level, I mean, on an intellectual level, or just during general normal times. So to delve in a bit deeper into what's happening here and what Ms. Merkel is talking about, first we need to really understand what multiculturalism is. Now, it was kind of conceived as a form of tolerance, generally supported by the political left, though there have been some left-wing critics, and we'll get to some of the reason why a bit later. But basically, it says that all cultures are equally valid. And so instead of saying, if you come to our country, you have to adapt to our way of life, speak our language, integrate into our culture, it says the opposite. It says, you know, our culture is no better than yours. What right have we to tell you what culture you should adopt and how you should live your life? Therefore, if you come to our country, you can keep your own culture and you can live whichever way you want. And so it sounds very nice and tolerant, but really, when you start to go through to the logical conclusion of multiculturalism, it has some very troubling implications. And George Friedman has an article on his new website, Geopolitical Futures. He, for those of you that like to read some of what Friedman writes, he's left Stratfor now. He started his own website, Geopolitical Futures. Very interesting website, and a lot of what he writes up there is available for free without a subscription. But he talks about Merkel's speech and multiculturalism. And in this article, he returns to a few themes that he's discussed quite a few times, which is this difference between the European and the American way of dealing with immigrants. And it's a good point, because in some ways, the best way to understand multiculturalism is to look at its opposite, which is the way America has typically dealt with migrants. Now, in recent years, America has become more like Europe. But if we look at America 100-200 years ago, it was very different. There was no multiculturalism. Instead, immigrants were expected to become Americanized. They were pushed to adopt American culture and an American identity. And in general, they did. And Theodore Roosevelt outlined these principles very clearly in his famous hyphenated American speech, where he said, "A hyphenated American is not an American at all." And the idea of this speech was, he was saying, you know, you can come from any country in the world and become an American and be a great American. But he was against people who came to America and considered themselves Irish Americans or English Americans or German Americans. And that's what he was talking about when he was talking about hyphenated Americans. And that's really the way America has dealt historically with immigration. No matter where you were born, you can come to America and become an American, but you have to adopt American culture and you have to give America your undivided loyalty. And now you can, that's the general approach. It's still perfectly tolerated for people to keep some of their cultural foods or some of their cultural holidays, because everyone likes a good variety of food and more excuses to party. But in general, they came and they adapted American culture. And that is exactly what multiculturalism isn't. And so if we look at Europe now, we see what multiculturalism naturally leads to. If you're keeping your own culture from your home nation, you're going to be most comfortable doing that around other people who have that same culture. And so you get immigrants, they're tending to come and group clump together in groups. And that's a general observation, and all generalizations are false at some point. So it doesn't apply to everyone. But now you get this situation in Europe where you have whole districts of cities where you get lots of people from one culture living together. And in his book Flashpoints, Friedman writes that given the economic status of immigrants the world over, the inevitable exclusion, perhaps unintentionally incorporated in multiculturalism, and the desire of like to live with like, the Muslims found themselves in extraordinarily crowded and squalid conditions. And so this is what we see in Europe. You know, just down the road from us here at Edstone is Birmingham. And there are some parts of Birmingham, some districts there that are 70% Muslim. 70%. And so there you have this whole district that is really a separate culture living there in the heart of another country. And then when you get that kind of concentration, then you know, most of the children in the school are Muslim. And so then they want the school to and the schools to have Muslim values and to put across the Muslim culture. And that's exactly what we've seen in Birmingham with things like the Trojan horse scandals that I think we discussed earlier in the year on this program. And then you get the local, you know, they want local government institutions as well to reflect that culture. And you see the same thing all across Europe, including Germany, because that's the natural consequence of multiculturalism. It's where it inevitably leads. But then it gets worse than that. And imagine and Friedman brings this out in his article that he had on the geopolitical futures, that imagine if in the 1800s, as Irish Americans moved to America, they were encouraged to not integrate, but instead to be multicultural. They're encouraged to keep their cultural differences. If they're encouraged to retain their hatred of the English and their passionate Catholicism that saw Protestantism as an enemy and that retained a whole load of these historical grievances. I don't want to get into the different sides and which side was white, right or wrong, but there were historical, very strong feelings on both sides due to the conflict in Ireland of Protestant and Catholicism. And so Friedman says, well, imagine if those feelings were encouraged to be retained as Irish Catholics started arriving in America. And so he wrote, holding on to their own culture and values would have meant holding on to the historic hatred, and that hatred that has bred war between Irish and Protestants, since the Irish at least had bitter memories and Catholics saw themselves as mortal enemies of Protestants. The result would have been transferring the European religious wars to the United States. As it was, there was substantial tension, but it was eroded over time by the cause toughness and simultaneous openness to partial to surrender. So there was a strong push there to assimilate these migrants into the American culture, and over time it worked. Even as it was, you know, for example, there were a bunch of Irish who came up with this kind of harebrained scheme to invade Canada and then somehow go to England and swap Canada for Ireland. Naturally, that didn't work, but there was certainly some tension, and we saw that even 100 years later with some in America, with some support for the IRA terrorist group. But that's beside the point. Encouraging cultural separation meant encouraging these kind of smoldering grievances. And Friedman talks about how you see that is what is going on in Europe right now, and people aren't encouraged to assimilate when they're encouraged to remain within their own culture. So he talked about how many come from the Middle East and they see themselves as being oppressed by Europe, not just in the Crusades, but throughout the 20th century. You know, they're poor and their nations are poor and their nations are having conflict in their worldview because of the evils of European colonization. And then either because they're poor or because of warfare, they decide to go and move to Europe. They end up in, for example, Germany. When they get there, they live with like-minded people outside of mainstream German culture and society. Again, because they're immigrants, they, as Friedman noted, they end up being kind of clumped together in these poorer neighborhoods. And so all of their grievances, rightly or wrongly, continue to get blamed on Europe and upon this German society that they're in. And then they never really interact with the mainstream core of that German society. And so any negative perceptions they have don't get changed, don't get challenged. They remain at the margins of the society. And then they all around, they kind of develop this victim culture. Everything that's wrong with their life is the fault of their European host country. And so then it becomes this fertile breeding ground for extremism. Now, that's not the experience for every single immigrant. Far, far from it. There are so many examples of where this doesn't happen, but it certainly does go on. You know, Mr. McDonald's in Germany right now, and he talked about, I think, may not have been on this program, but about how last time he was in Germany, in Austria, you know, some of the Muslim immigrants from the 80s and 90s are upset about the latest wave of immigration for many of the same reason that native Germans are upset about the native, about this wave of immigration. And there are definitely ones that come in. They do end up integrating to a certain extent with the host culture, but there are many that don't and just end up in what are these virtual ghettos, marginalized and outside of mainstream German society and brewing in this victim culture. And this has become now such a problem that mainstream European leaders are being forced to acknowledge this and accept this. Ones who 15, 20 years ago would have never dreamed of making any of these kind of statements. And so that is essentially what Ms. Merkel was saying. Multiculturalism is a sham because it encourages immigrants to live apart in these ghettos rather than becoming Germans. And even someone like David Cameron, who is far, far from being far right, has made similar critiques of multiculturalism. So they see at least some of the problems, but how do you solve it? That is much, much harder. Look at Angela Merkel. She talked about this problem with multiculturalism 10 years ago, 2004. So we're coming up now, I guess it'd be 11 years ago, it's right at the end of 2004. And since then, she's done nothing to solve it. You know, she kind of talked about it being a problem, left it for another 5 years, talked about it being a problem again, still has done nothing. And look, this multiculturalism is at the foundation of how Germany and of how Europe deals with immigrants. It would be, and they're not doing anything. They see the problem, but they're not doing anything to fix it. It would be like us walking around the Edstone cellar, you know, and saying, well, these foundations of this building are deceptive. They've utterly, utterly failed. They may look strong, but it's a lie. Already the building is starting to subside. You know, these foundations are flawed. The whole building could collapse. And then we just kind of go back to whatever we were doing and completely ignore it. And then maybe 5 years later, come back down in the basement, make the same kind of comments, and then just go back to living in the house and working in the house as normal. So they're talking about the problem very occasionally. It's still, it's only every few years that she brings this up. So they're talking about it, but nobody has any real solutions. To Ms. Merkel, really, the solution, if you could call it that, it was more of an idea that she put forward, or an ideal that she put forward in her speech, is to instead allow and encourage these immigrants to become German. But that has a whole number of problems. You know, one, fundamentally, is that for the last few hundred years, being German has been defined by race. You know, what makes you a German? Well, I'm descended from Germans. The same with what makes you British or French. And Ms. Merkel wants to change that, to make being German more about having a set of values and a shared culture rather than a shared ancestry, kind of a bit more like nationality in the US. But how do you change the entire foundation of a national identity? There have been those kind of pushing this idea for some time now, but it's not really caught on. And then how do you do that in just a short amount of time? You know, Europe does not have decades to slowly change what it means to be a European or to be French or German or Polish. This immigration crisis and the crisis that multiculturalism has led to is something that's happening right now that needs a solution in terms of months, if even that, not decades, as changing the foundation of a national identity would lead to. And after all, really, as Friedman points out, multiculturalism, even though it's been embraced by a lot of people on its left, when you start to really look at what it means and examine it in depth, it is quite a far right idea. You know, it's saying a foreigner can't be a true German, therefore we'll encourage them to live as their own culture. And that really is at the heart the logical conclusion of multiculturalism. It begins as kind of this woolly idea of tolerance, but at the heart, really, it's kind of racist, or at least race-based. And that's why, as I said, that there are left-wing critics of multiculturalism out there. They see and understand this. But the other problem here with Merkel's kind of ideal of just hoping all the immigrants start to identify more with Germany is, how practically do you put forward an alternative to multiculturalism? You know, how do you try and change this now that you have districts of cities that are 60-70% Muslim? How do you go in there and make it culturally German? You know, she didn't address any of the practicalities or specifics at all. And there's a huge gulf between the cultures here. In general, some of these immigrants, especially the Muslim ones, are much more religious than native Germans. You know, you're not going to get them eating bratwurst and dressing up in lederhosen and going to Oktoberfest. And I'm sorry to stereotype Germans, but not the least because the Muslim religion forbids them from eating pork sausages and drinking beer. Their religion just, it's a kind of trite example, but the religion is so much more part of their daily life than it is to German. It makes that change very hard. I mean, depending on how you look at it, the modern culture of Europe is either secular or it's Christian. And so how do you integrate a devout Muslim into that culture? That's hard. It means very, very, even very big changes to what it means to be a German or a European. And so Miss Merkel, she brought up what is really a very big problem in her speech, but she has no way to solve this. And, you know, there is a big crisis building in Germany because of this. Yesterday, I was working on the Europe section of the Trumpet Weekly. And a lot of the articles and things that we're quoting and talking about on this program today come straight from that. That's a free publication that we put together with some of the best news of the week. And you can get it emailed to you for free every week by signing up to thetrumpet.com. And we're going to talk about that a little later on KPCG on Trumpet Hour. But one of the best articles in there this week was from Spiegel Online, and it's called Fear, Anger, and Hatred: The Rise of Germany's New Right. And it was quite hard. There's tons of good material in that article, and it was really hard just to choose a few excerpts to put in the Trumpet Weekly, because it is rather a long article. But it talks about how this kind of anti-immigration position within Germany used to be only on the far fringes of society, and now it's moving much more mainstream. And in this article, they write, in the past, the right wing was characterized primarily by thugs with shaved heads, bomber jackets, and jackboots. These street extremists are still around, but they have received reinforcements. The new right comes out of the bourgeois center of society and includes intellectuals with conservative values, devout Christians, and those angry at the political class. The new movement also attracts people that might otherwise be described as leftists. Putin admirers, for example, anti-globalization activists, and radical pacifists. Movements are growing together that have never before been part of the same camp. And so it's talking about this rise of a new right-wing movement within Germany in response to the migrant crisis, in response to these problems that have been building for years because of the failures of multiculturalism. And in this article, they go through some stats from a recent survey showing that Germans are becoming more uneasy. They're becoming more worried about immigration and the consequences of this. It also talks about how anti-immigration is becoming worse. The number of attacks and the type of attacks are both becoming worse. Then when it comes to talking about the people that are committing these attacks, they write, an analysis performed by Germany's Federal Criminal Police Office has determined that the perpetrators are not always white right-wing extremists. Not even a third of the perpetrators identified have had previous encounters with the authorities. The majority had spotless records before they marched off to their local refugee hospital. Then a bit later they say, it seems as if the refugee crisis is bundling the suppressed fears of German society and stirring them into an explosive mixture. So it's causing major problems. Now you're getting people who in previous years never broke the law, would never dream of this kind of thing probably 5-10 years ago. And some of these people are now going and setting fire to immigration centers. Now, going and setting fire to baby carriages that belongs to immigrants, have some people have done, is abhorrent, is evil, is never, ever justifiable. But it's also to be expected. This is the kind of thing that happens. This is the you know, where people have seen that this multiculturalism is leading for a long time. You know, what is justifiable is this growing unease and concern within Germany. And last time he was on this program, Mr. McDonald gave a fascinating overview of how we can expect Germany to respond. And I believe that's something that will be up on our website soon, and maybe in a print edition of The Trumpet as well. I think that's not a promise. But there is a major problem here, and at least Ms. Merkel sees it. She's seen it for 10 years and not fixed it. There's a problem with the immigrants that have come in and they're becoming more radicalized. Then there's a genuine problem within Germany, genuine concern, genuine fear. But then this inevitably leads into a rise in actual extremism and violence within Germany too. And so you've got this crisis that I won't go into too much more detail, because we've talked about that a fair bit in the past, building. Now, Friedman, in this article on the Geopolitical Futures website, he concludes his article by talking about how Ms. Merkel has no solution to this problem, how she gives really no solution, like we've talked about. And then he makes some striking points about the scale of these problems. He concludes this article by writing, "The refugees are not there to become Europeans, and the Europeans have no way of making them Europeans." And then he writes, "The multicultural ghetto has failed. There seems to be no option other than conflict. In a continent whose population is declining and who needs more, not less, guests to do the work that there are no longer Germans to do. So there's no option other than conflict." That's the type of problem that is building with the growth of that multiculturalism has led to, and now this pushback against multiculturalism and immigration. I think Friedman is one of the smartest and most logical analysts of world events out there when it comes to an intellectual understanding of what is happening in the world. He has a good understanding of history, geography, even some accurate insights into human nature, or some accurate understanding. I think Mr. Fraser met him a few times and mentioned that he did used to listen to some of Mr. Armstrong. I don't know how much of that he may remember, or how much that influenced him, if at all. I'm sure it did somewhat, given that he does have some of this, some good understanding. But when you read what he's writing about Europe over the last year or so, it really is quite apocalyptic. We've quoted a few times what he wrote after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and how he wrote this article talking about how he saw no alternative in the long run to another round of ghettoization and deportation. And his book that he came out with at the start of this year, Flashpoints, in some ways is even more dramatic. After going through this whole book, examining the history of Europe, its current situation, on the very last page of the book, he writes, "The idea that Europe has moved beyond using armed conflict to settle its issues is a fantasy." And the final words in this book are, "The Europeans are still human, and they will still encounter terrible choices like those that others face and that they have faced in the past. They will have to choose between war and peace. And as in the past, they will, at times, choose war. Nothing has ended. For humans, nothing significant is ever over." So that's a very bleak assessment from a very intelligent man. But that is the logical conclusion of what we see brewing in Europe today. And he can see where the direction that all this is going in. Now, when I was looking into this subject, I went back and looked at Ms. Merkel's previous comments on multiculturalism and what we'd written on The Trumpet on this subject. And the very first time, back in December 2004, when she brought this trumpet up, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory, he devoted his From the Editor article of the January 2005 Trumpet to this subject. And he talked about where this shift within Germany against multiculturalism is moving, and this kind of what then was still a very nascent right-wing movement. And as the Spiegel article notes, the new right that we see today has its roots in that more historic movement that we saw in smaller stages back in 2005. And Mr. Flory back then talked about where it was leading. And he wrote in that article, "A powerful right-wing Germany is far more dangerous to America than terrorism is. We just don't know it yet." And that's why we look at what's brewing in Europe, what's going on in Germany so much on this program. You know, ISIS are bad. ISIS are dangerous. But what is happening in Europe is going to destabilize the world far, far more. But here at The Trumpet, as all of our regular listeners and readers will know, we don't just use history and logic to guide us in our analysis. We rely on Bible prophecy. And it points us the same way that history and logic do it. We can use it, really draw on those to back that up. But the addition of Bible prophecy, as well as giving us more detail and just a much more infallible guide, it also gives us hope. You know, if you start thinking deeply about what a future that includes more wars coming from Europe means, that's a very bleak picture. You know, this Europe is the continent that launched World War I, World War II, even going before that, things like the Seven Years' War that some have called really the First World War. And so, you know, to say that Europe will be involved in more wars is really quite horrifying. But Bible prophecy gives us hope. A hope that we can't get just from this kind of cold logical analysis of world events. You know, as Friedman said, man cannot end wars. He will keep repeating them, keep repeating this way of life until he finally destroys himself. But the Bible gives us hope that God will stop that, that he will stop the violence, that he will end this cycle of war. He'll teach man the way to peace. And if you want to learn more about that and what we've been saying on this, we have a little booklet called We Have Had Our Last Chance that you can get for free on our website at thetrumpet.com. Now, that's roughly all we've got time for. I'll end this a little early. I've got to start recording the Trumpet Hour Week in Review in a few minutes now. You know, that will be aired a little later today. I think it goes out, 10 p.m. UK time, so that's about 4 p.m. Well, that is 4 p.m. Central Standard Time in the U.S., where we'll go over with all of us an overview of what's been going on in Europe that week. As usual, you can catch up with anything that you've missed on KPCG on our website at kpcg.fm, on SoundCloud, on the TuneIn app, however you like to listen. So that's it from me today on Trumpet Hour, and keep coming back at KPCG 101.3.fm. Or on the FM dial.